Hi, I'm Patricia Carvelis. I'm the host of the ABC's podcast Politics Now, where I'm joined by the sharpest political journalists at the ABC to bring you the big stories you need to know.
You'll hear analysis of the week that was in politics with me, Fran Kelly, joining PK for the party room.
And on Insiders on Background, join me, David Spears, as I zoom in on one big story and a key voice behind it, diving deeper into the policies, laws and people shaping our landscape.
All in the Politics Now feed. Search Politics Now on ABC Listen and hit follow so you never miss an episode.
From Wurundjeri Country, I'm Luke Sidham Dundon, and today on The Breakfast Wrap, the Prime Minister is under fire for comments that he's made about calls for a royal commission into domestic violence. You're going to hear what he's had to say, and you're also going to hear a response from one of his colleagues, the Minister for Social Services, Tanya Plibersek. It's a pretty insightful interview. You'll want to listen to what she has to say. Then, UN Special Rapporteur Francesca Albanese talks to us about the aid flotilla featuring nearly a dozen Australians detained by Israeli forces.
Israel has absolutely no right to intercept, to abduct civilian vessels in international waters.
And later, it is the end of an era in late night.
I can finally speak unvarnished truth to power and say what I really think about Donald Trump. I don't care for him.
Stephen Colbert goes out swinging against the president. That is all coming up from the Radio National Breakfast team on The Breakfast Wrap.
That's in now 4 days of women, and we were yet to hear anything, any government official, especially yourself, Prime Minister, talk about it.
So you may have seen a clip of this moment online at some point throughout the week. A few days ago, Prime Minister Anthony Albanese was on Hobart's hit 100.9 FM radio station, and he was asked about the government's response to calls for a royal commission into domestic violence. Now, this follows 4 alleged domestic violence killings in as many days, something that the presenter, Christy Hayes, raised with the PM.
I know that there is a call for a royal commission into the deaths of women. There's 90,000 signatures so far. What does your government feel about that? Will we see this royal commission?
Look, there's calls for a royal commission about everything.
Well, you've, I think deaths of women are pretty paramount,
wouldn't
you say?
Yeah, there are, but you've got to work out, what does a royal commission do besides fund lawyers? What we need here is solutions that we know. We know what they are. We know what's required here. And I understand that people, when confronted with an issue, will call for royal commissions. But, we know that there's too much violence against women. We know what keeps women in these relationships.
So this morning, we arranged to speak with the Minister for Social Services, Tanya Plibersek, about an announcement the government was making today. It's launching consultation to guide its efforts over the next 5 years to end violence against women and children. In that interview, we played her the clip that you just heard, and then Sally asked her this question.
What did you make of the Prime Minister's tone in that interview? Did he get it right, Minister, in your view?
Well, I understand why people call for a royal commission into the deaths of women and into family domestic and sexual violence, because it is one of the most important issues confronting us as a country. It's a huge issue with a huge impact on way too many people and way too many families. But I think the point the Prime Minister was making is that frontline workers will tell you we've had 8 royal commissions and major inquiries in recent years with more than 1,000 recommendations. We know so much of what we need to be doing. This is not a question we need to investigate. We know what drives gendered violence. We know what the solutions are. We have to get on with the action. And that's why today we're launching the consultation on our second action plan, on the national plan to end violence against women and their children. We need to keep evolving our response to make sure that we're keeping up with the changes that are happening in our society. So one of the things we've noticed, for example, is that offences between young people, so victim younger than 18, perpetrator younger than 18, have really increased in recent years. We know huge impact of non-consensual choking in sex, I think being driven by some of the violent and degrading pornography we're seeing online that young people are exposed to from a very young age. That's gone through the roof. Tech-facilitated abuse, things like stalking apps hidden on phones and computers, again, gone through the roof. We need to keep evolving what we're doing to keep up with the changes that we're seeing. We need to keep investing. We need sustained action, Sally. And I understand that the calls for a Royal Commission are about how huge this problem is and how serious this problem is. But we've identified the problem now. We need sustained action on delivering on the things that frontline workers continue to tell us we need to do better on.
The way in which you're explaining that and the tone in which you're doing it, it sounds quite different from the way the PM was answering that question. On reflection, could there have been a better way to respond to that question, a more respectful way?
Look, I think it's unfair to suggest that the tone... Look, I know Anthony cares about this. He was exposed to domestic violence as a child. He saw his mother exposed to it. He's spoken about that, not often, but he's spoken about that and the toll that that took in his family and on him as a child. It is something that we take seriously from the Prime Minister right through our government. We've invested more than any other government, $4.4 billion so far in additional measures to help keep women and children safe. Now, I'm not saying that's enough. I'm never going to say that it's enough while a single person is frightened or subject to violence. I'm never going to say, job done, we can relax. We need to continue to drive the actions that we know make a difference. And I know the Prime Minister is committed to doing that.
Mm. Delia Donovan, who works on the front line of these issues, the CEO of Domestic Violence New South Wales, we spoke with her on the program a few days ago. She said she had a real fear that Australians are getting numb to the term national crisis. Is violence against women and children, is it understood fully, the devastating impact that it has?
No, it's not. And I have... I don't know how to describe this, but I have the responsibility of speaking so often with family members who have lost someone they love, and speaking to people who've been impacted by violence in their daily lives. And I don't think you can overstate the toll this takes. The gap that's left when we lose someone and the lifelong impact of experiencing violence, I don't think you can overstate how important this is. The statistics are overwhelming. Like, police will tell you it's 60% of their work, and we know these crimes are underreported. Well, what does that mean? It means that this is... every day, every hour, every minute, impacting someone in this country in a way that profoundly changes their life. I don't think we can overstate its importance as an issue in this country, and the responsibility on us as governments to lead. The Commonwealth government, the states and territories obviously have responsibility for a lot of the frontline service delivery, like policing, like courts, the justice response. I would also say, Sally, that governments need to lead, but all of us need to change. All of us need to keep this front and centre, not just when another horrific death is reported, but always. This is going to take our whole community to change. Violence is learnt, as respect is learnt. And what we know is that for boys in particular, one of the best protective factors is having a close and loving relationship with a male role model, a father or a grandfather or a sporting coach or a teacher that teaches them how to be a good, decent man and not use violence or control in interpersonal relationships. We know that we need to change women's ability to leave a relationship economically. Mm. We need to, you know, that's why we focus on things like reducing the gender pay gap and making sure we've got that $1.2 billion of crisis and transitional housing and making sure we've got that leaving violence payment of up to $5,000 support and safety planning available. We need to put all of these pieces together as a society, levels of government and if you're a sporting coach, if you're a teacher, if you're a parent, you have the greatest opportunity to make sure that we don't generation after generation continue these behaviours. One of the things that concerns me most right now is that offending rates where both the perpetrator and the victim are under the age of 18 have ballooned, have really exploded. And what does that tell us about the incidence of violence in future generations if we don't address that now? We know that the needs of children who have grown up in families where there's domestic violence are not addressed in the way they need to be. We've started that, more than $80 million into children's counselling, but there's so much more we need to do for children. We need to make sure that our respectful relationships and programs in schools are actually making a difference from kindergarten right through year 12, not, you know, one guest speaker in year 9 and then we forget about it. We need to make sure that our schools, all of our sporting clubs, all of us work together with the same message that violence and control in relationships is never okay.
And that is the Minister for Social Services, Tanya Plibersek, talking about the government's strategy for ending violence against women and children. And hearing stories like this can be particularly triggering for a lot of people. If it has raised any issues for you, there is a number you can call. You can get help by calling the National Sexual Assault, Domestic and Family Violence Counselling Service. That's on 1-800-RESPECT, which is 1-800-737-732. We're going to turn to major news overseas because the 11 Australians on board a flotilla headed for Gaza are now returning home after being detained by Israeli security forces. Footage published of Israel's National Security Minister, Itamar Ben-Gvir, mocking and taunting the detainees as they're bound and kneeling, has sparked diplomatic outrage around the world, particularly from countries whose citizens were on board the boats. Here's what a number of Australian politicians have said about this footage, including Green Senator Nick McKim, this morning on Radio National Breakfast.
My reaction, I suspect, is the same as most Australians who've seen some of the footage of that treatment. That is abhorrent treatment of people by a senior figure in the Israeli government. People are being degraded. They're having their human rights abused. It is effectively a form of torture. And the simple fact is that Israel is now a rogue state. They're kidnapping people, including Australian citizens, from international waters on the high seas. It's basically an act of piracy. They are illegally taking them into Israel. And then when they get them into Israel, they are abusing and degrading them. I mean, this demands the strongest possible response from our Prime Minister and our Foreign Minister, a far, far stronger response than they've delivered to date.
And here is what the government is saying, because we also asked Tanya Plibersek about this footage this morning.
I thought the behaviour was shameful.
What do you mean?
I think it was disgraceful. I think it was absolutely disgraceful behaviour, and I'm very pleased to say that the Foreign Minister has said that in the strongest terms to the Israeli government. Our Australian ambassador in Israel has made the position of the Australian government very clear that this behaviour is completely unacceptable.
Australia's Foreign Minister, Penny Wong, says Israel's ambassador to Australia will be hauled before the Department of Foreign Affairs to reinforce the government's disapproval. And last night on the ABC 7:30 program, the ambassador, Dr. Hillel Newman, had this message.
There's no big gap between Israel and Australia on this because we have condemned what Ben-Gvir, Minister Ben-Gvir, has done from wall to wall in Israel. The leadership of Israel has condemned what he did. It's disgraceful. That's not the approach of the government of Israel. It's not the policy of the government of Israel. It doesn't reflect the values of the state of Israel. In fact, the whole flotilla was dealt with great sensitivity. No one was hurt. The interception was done very smoothly. This humiliation, which was done by Ben-Gvir after they had already reached a safe ground, was not to be done, and it's been condemned by the leadership of Israel.
He also refused to apologise And he said that the actual flotilla itself wasn't justified in sailing to Gaza. Now, listening in when we played that audio on the program this morning was the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the Occupied Palestinian Territories, Francesca Albanese. And here's what Sally asked her about the ambassador's comments.
Is condemning these actions enough?
Absolutely not. I mean, I understand the Israeli ambassador to Australia was speaking before. I mean, understand, like many others, they're scratching in Israel, they're scratching the barrel to justify these actions. But there are, let's unpack what he just said. First of all, no, Israel has absolutely no right to intercept, to abduct civilian vessels in international waters, let alone deporting or forcefully transferring whomever is on these vessels to Israel. Second, it's not the first time that Israel abuses and or humiliates and treats in a degrading fashion the flotilla activists and others. And this is just a micro dose of what Palestinians have endured over the past 3 years and before, but over the past 3 years, even the UN Committee Against Torture, which is quite a conservative body, has concluded that Israel has a policy to torture Palestinians. And I've myself investigated the matter for 6 months and concluded that torture is part and parcel of the intentional destruction of the Palestinian people. The last comment I wanted to make is that the blockade is unlawful, and therefore it should be states and not civilians and not activists from all over the world breaking it. The ICJ, the International Court of Justice, has ordered Israel to dismantle the occupation totally and unconditionally. So there are no excuses. And by the way, of course they should apologize to the flotilla, to the Palestinians, to the entire world for what Israel has been doing over the past 3 years.
The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu himself has said that the security minister's actions are not in line with Israel's values. What obligation do you think the Prime Minister has to take action against his security minister?
Look, I heard the Foreign Minister of Spain saying something extremely important and intelligent. A minister binds the government. In a normal country, A word of condemnation will not suffice. And therefore, Minister Ben-Gvir, in a normal country, would already be out of the government because what he has done is unacceptable. But let me tell you, it's not just what he had done to the flotilla. Ben-Gvir is the mastermind of the so-called, quote-unquote, prison revolution, which has turned Israeli detention centers into what Israeli human rights organizations called torture centers, torture networks. So, no, of course, it's not sufficient what Benjamin Netanyahu said. But again, Benjamin Netanyahu, who's wanted himself by the ICC for war crimes and crimes against humanity, so instead of speaking from Tel Aviv, he should be in The Hague as we speak and responding for its alleged crimes. But of course, Ben-Gvir wants to repair the situation, but it's broken. I mean, Israel is exposed, and the more the situation and the genocide in Palestine continues, the more it will lose the possibility to redeem itself in the eyes of the international community.
Francesca Albanese, thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you. All the best.
And that was the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the Occupied Palestinian Territories, Francesca Albanese. She was speaking with Sally Sara on Radio National Breakfast this morning. And apologies for the scratchy phone line, but that was an important interview in this story. Well, we're going to end on one of the biggest media stories in the world today because the top rating host of late night TV in the States will be out of a job at the end of the day. The axing of The Late Show with Stephen Colbert was a financial decision, according to network CBS. But there's a lot of skepticism of that claim because if you look at what he has said, particularly about the president, you may form another opinion.
The network will be ending The Late Show in May.
And now for the next 10 months, the gloves are off. I can finally speak unvarnished truth to power and say what I really think about Donald Trump. I don't care for him. On Friday, Donald Trump posted, "I absolutely love that Colbert got fired. His talent was even less than his ratings." I gotta say, Donald Trump has proven himself surprisingly limber for a man with those cankles.
I have a great plan. The plan is they cannot have a nuclear weapon.
Yes. He has such a simple plan. In fact, the only thing simpler than the plan is the man who has it.
So CBS announced it was cancelling this show last year. At the same time, its corporate parent, Paramount, was negotiating a takeover by billionaire David Ellison's Skydance. Ellison, friends with Donald Trump. The dynamics of all of this could be a podcast in itself. The finale of The Late Show airs this afternoon, Australian time, marking what many believe could be the beginning of the end of the network talk show genre. Bill Carter is one of the most well-versed commentators on late-night TV over in the States. He's a former New York Times media reporter who has authored two books on the genre, and he spoke to Sally this morning.
Bill, as someone who's studied and reported on the politics of late-night shows in the US for a long time, how do you reflect on the end of The Late Show?
Well, I mean, it's the first of its kind in a way. I mean, people have lost their jobs in late night because they weren't doing well, or they've left because they've done it a long time or gotten a better job. This is the first time a person was forced out by apparent government interference, which is not just a surprise, but also kind of a shock to Americans who thought we didn't do that kind of thing in this country.
So what role do you think politics played in Paramount's relationship with the Trump administration during this Skydance merger? How much did that decision have on axing this show?
Well, we can only infer because, of course, they declared that the politics had nothing to do with it. But the circumstance was that Paramount was trying to sell or merge, and Skydance was going to take over, and they needed government approval for that. And the government in place does not like Stephen Colbert at all, not at all. And among other things they did was they settled a lawsuit that our biggest news program had been fighting Trump over, and then Trump really had no strong basis for the suit, but they caved and gave him money over that, and that was a sign. And only shortly after Colbert came on the air and mocked that settlement, calling it a big fat bribe, I think it was 3 days later they canceled him. And then a week later, the merger closed. So the circumstances are screaming at you that there are political implications behind this. And you can't say, unless you were in the meeting, that somebody said, hey, we better do this or Trump is going to not approve the merger. But since Trump had done many similar things and tried to intimidate, you know, universities and corporations and networks in other ways, it made sense that people that this is what was really going on.
Why did President Donald Trump not like this show?
Well, Stephen Colbert, you may know his previous show, he was he played a character who was a blowhard conservative character, and he was incredibly great at this. I mean, like, incredibly great at it. And I thought the show was hilarious. Then he took over what we consider a standard late night show with a host behind a desk doing a monologue. And at first he wasn't great. And I think it was because he had sort of abandoned his point of view voice. But when he went back to that, and he has a point of view, he has a very strong point of view that, you know, is very inconsistent with what Trump believes. He found his voice and people liked it. And he definitely, you know, ripped Trump often. But Trump gives all the late night guys a lot of ammunition. It's not like they have to go really strain themselves to find something to satirize. He does an awful lot. And Colbert is an unflinching guy like that. And he obviously had a point of view. He has a voice. It's in America. We have a free speech. And he could say what he wants, just as Trump could come on and say he has no talent and he has no ratings, both of which are patently untrue.
And that is the former New York Times media reporter, Bill Carter, the author of two books on the late night genre, one of the leading commentators on late night TV over in the States. Well, thank you so much for listening to all the interviews across the week on The Breakfast Wrap, presented by Sally Sara and produced by our wonderfully hardworking Radio National Breakfast team. The Breakfast Wrap was produced this week by Oscar Coleman, and our executive producer, sitting in the chair for Eleni Soltis, was Jason Whittaker. I'm Luke Sidham-Dundon. We will be back in your ears on Monday.